Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the second day of Tevet, which in many, many years is the eighth day of Chanukah, so it's sometimes referred to as Zot Chanukah, Zayin Aleph being eight in Gematria, so you turn it into Zot Chanukah, and on that last day of Chanukah, you read the part of the Torah where the Torah says, Zot Chanukah Tamizbeach, so that's a nice play on words, so sometimes the Meshivim, the respondents, will refer to it as Zot Chanukah, the second day of Tevet. Depends on how many days in Cheshvan there are. If there are two days of Rosh Chodesh Tevet or one. Anyway, so for today I'm going to do something a little different. I'm starting with a response that was written on the second day of Tevet on Zot Chanukah, but it wasn't. Now you don't always have a lot of choices, and this was the choice that struck me as an interesting choice, sort of out of the box a little bit, because it's going to be a letter that the Tzitz Eliezer wrote to a man named Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky. So we'll see that letter, and then I'll explain what I'm going to do. So this tshuva is from Shut Tzitz Eliezer Chelek Dalet Simon Hey Perek Dalet. It's part of a long responsum that he sent to Rav Aaron Zaslansky, and the piece of it that I took was about issues of Lifnei Iver. In a case where you can assume, or you have the that you can assume, you have the ability to construct a reality in which the person that you're going to give the item to will not use it for sin. The problem of Lifnei Iver is that Jews are not, by Torah law, they're not allowed to help other Jews sin. They're not allowed to put other Jews in the position of sinning. So then it becomes the whole question of, is my action going to be the action that leads the Jew to sin? So a classic example of it is, let's suppose there's a Nazir. A Nazir is not allowed to drink wine. It's part of his vow, his oath of Nazirut, that he's not allowed to drink wine. So let's suppose you have a Nazir, and the only way he can get to some wine is by asking me for it. Now, I am not, by Torah law, allowed to give it to him because of the pasuk of Lifnei Iver, lo titein michshol. Literally, it means don't put a stumbling block before the blind person. Halachically, it means that we're not allowed to help other people do things that are sinful. It's a complicated sugya because there's all questions of to what extent am I the one who's helping him? Can he get it on his own? Would he do it anyway? All sorts of issues that it's not our issue today, and therefore I'm not going to get into a full discussion of Lifnei Iver. We've countered it a couple other times, sort of come up by the way. So in this long tshuva, you know it's a long tshuva because it's got four chapters at least, right? This is in Chelek Dalet Simon Hey, but this is Perek Dalet. One option would have been for me to go through the whole tshuva to Rav Aaron Zaslansky. I think that was too long, and then also an interesting issue came up because I didn't know who this Rav Aaron Zaslansky was. He's not identified in this responsum at all. So this is from the second day of Tevet, Zot Chanukah of Tov Shin Yud Aleph of 1950, Chanukah of late 1950, of December 1950. Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky. So he says to him, I appreciated getting your comments on my book, Shvitat Hayam. Rav Eliezer is known for Tzitz Eliezer, but he wrote other Sfarim as well. He was really very prolific. So early in his life, in 1950 is when he's in his early 30s, early to mid-30s. I think Shvitat Hayam was about the issues of traveling on Shabbos and on boats and things like that. So then, along the way, came up in the question of Lifnei Iver. So the Tzitz Eliezer had apparently taken the position as most Gedolei Hador, as most of his predecessors had done. I mean, he wasn't taking anything revolutionary. He wasn't taking a new position here. That as long as you can be tole, as long as there's a possibility that the Jew will use it for purposes that are not sinful purposes, you're allowed to do so. So an example that comes up in this response is, let's say you have a cow that's mostly used for plowing fields, and it's a Shemitah year, and you know a Jew who's not so observant who comes to buy a cow from you. Do you have to worry that he's going to use the cow for that purpose? So the halacha is you're allowed to assume that maybe he's going to use the cow to shecht it. You're allowed to use that he's going to eat it for meat, even though that's not the likeliest possibility, that you're allowed to be tola. So that's what a tliya is. A tliya is when we're allowed to assume a possible past or a possible future. So that's what a tliya is. So he's taking the position that as long as I can be tola, then he'll do it in a good way, in a possible right way, I'm allowed to be tola. So the Rishon of Zaslansky had written to him that there is a Tosos Anshei Shem, which is a Rishon, who quoted somebody else about a Mishnah in Shavit. The Mishnah in Shavit is about a different kind of a Shemitah issue, and it said that you're allowed to sell people 5 jugs of oil and 15 wine containers. That's what they're usually used for. And the reason the Mishnah gives is that that's how much people will generally bring from Hefker to use for their purposes. The Lach in Shemitah is, let's remember in Shemitah, the Lach isn't that you're not allowed to eat fruit or vegetables or produce. The Lach is that you're only allowed to gather as much fruit, vegetables, produce as you need, as you yourself will need or your family will need. You're allowed to gather only for personal purposes. You're not allowed to gather and make a business out of it. So that means, and you have to use it up by what's called Shatabi, or by the time that produce would have been gone from the fields or wherever it's grown, you have to have finished using all of your Shemitah stuff. So that creates all sorts of problems, all sorts of issues. It's not our topic today at all, but that's a Shemitah question. So the Mishnah says you can sell them these number of containers because that's the number of containers they generally use for the right amount to take for their own personal uses. And if somebody filled up those jugs and those containers with that amount of wine or oil from Hefker, there's no big problem. There's no big issue. The problem is, the concern is, well, maybe that's not what they're going to do. Maybe they're going to fill all of it with wine or all of it with oil, taking more than they should be taking. So the answer that was given there in that whole conversation, which is not our whole issue, but that maybe the idea of a tliyah, that we're allowed to assume things about the person that we're selling something to or giving something to, is only when the possibilities are roughly equal, when they're shkulim, when the possibility to do it the right way is roughly equal to them do it the wrong way. That would mean in other situations where, he also pointed out that the Rambam wrote that we're not told in a chashut, that if somebody's already suspected of violating Shavita, then we're not told in that way. So that's what Rav Zaslansky had claimed. And therefore, he said that it's not so clear that you'd be able to be tola in all the ways that the Tzitzit Ezra thought you could be tola in various issues that, again, aren't our current issue. And the reason why it's not our current issue is because I'm going to spend our time more trying to get to know this Rav Zaslansky a little bit better rather than the specific halachic issues that come up. So these are all things that one can research more on their own if they want to. So Rav Zaslansky's answer to this question is, he doesn't think that the proof pushes aside his idea that he had gotten from really the consensus of Rishonim and Achronim that we can allow ourselves to be tola in any tliya that we need. And that's based on, Rav Yochanan elsewhere talks about the fact that Beis Hillel seemed to be allow selling olives that have not yet been had tithes taken from them, not yet been muhushru lekabel tuma. So when produce is taken out of the field, until it gets wet, it's impossible for it to become tamei tumat achle. It's possible for it to get ritual impurity that comes to foods, because not yet considered a food that's ready to be used. But once it gets wet, and the owner wanted it to get wet, then it's muhushru lekabel tuma. So if you have a person who we don't know to be careful about tuma and tara issues, and there aren't many such people, right? So it's a complicated series of laws. You're probably not supposed to give them, we're not ideally supposed to give them stuff because we worry that they will wash these olives, which are now hukshu l'kabel tuma, which are now susceptible to ritual impurity, and then they won't be careful with them before they take truma and maaser and things like that from them, and then you'll have done that b'isser, you'll have done b'tuma, which you weren't supposed to, you'll have like ruined it. So Beis Hillel say no, but you can give it to them, and the assumption seems to be you can give it to them because you can be tola, you can assume, you can work on the operating assumption they will treat it properly. And Beis Hillel seems to be following their opinion, because we have another mission that says you shouldn't sell a parach or reshet b'shvi'it, that is, if somebody who were not positive keeps, sure, we have reason to believe, doesn't keep Shemitah the right way. So if you have, like I said before, a cow that is usually used for plowing, the Tanakhama, the Mishnah, but you shouldn't sell it to them during Shemitah year. But he'll say you can, because he could kill it. He could eat it for the meat. So based on that, Beit Hillel, many, many Rishonim and Achronim, the Tzitzit Ezra is saying, accepted the possibility of that we can be told that in any possible tliyah. So too, he says, he saw in a chasm so fair that you do this, that anytime you have a plausible option, any kind of an, not even so plausible, any kind of an option that they will go the right way, you're allowed to follow that way and to deal with them. And part of the reason for that is the fact that you have a question. So, in other words, we're not going to answer really so much the question that Kedusha and Shashem gave, the question of the selling them only five jugs of oil and 15 containers of wine. We're not going to answer that in this tshuva, but the fact that we don't have a current answer, so there's a right to shari tirutzim lo ninalu. The gates of answers have never been closed. Even if we don't right now find an answer to a question, if we have a well-established halakhic principle, this is an important thing. You have a well-established halakhic principle, and somebody comes with a great question, and you don't know the answer to that question, it doesn't mean you immediately strike down the principle. That's what they're just saying. So I have a principle from hundreds of years, from many, many authorities, that we are tola in terms of the neiver, in terms of whether or not we view an action we're doing as leading somebody to sin. We are tola in whatever tliya we can come up with. We allow ourselves to make various assumptions that it will go in a positive, possible, reasonable way, that we're allowed to think that it's not going to create sin. And that's even though you have this pretty interesting question, that it seems like there's a source the other way. And even if we can't find the answer to that, I like that idea, because I think there are times in Jewish history when questions have come up and they may be there for generations, and there's no answer to them, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we really change what we do. That kind of conservatism, the ability to recognize there might be a hard question out there, we're not sure the answer to that question, and yet, we don't know what to do about it. In this case, I'm sorry, he is going to give us an answer to this question. He says, I think there are two answers. The first answer, based on the fact that the whole question isn't as well stated as it could be. The question is whether this person is really going to fill up his jugs with 15, with five things of wine, of oil, and 15 things of wine, or maybe he'll do it all wine and oil, all oil. So his first answer is he thinks the question there was never a lifnei iver question. It wasn't that Chazal were worried about what if he doesn't do it the right way in terms of am I not helping him sin? Because in fact, we hold, in other words, in fact, we hold that you can be assume whatever you want to assume about him. As long as you have some kind of an assumption that he'll do it the right way, then you're allowed to assume he'll do it the right way. And that's not the issue. The issue is if he can circumvent it, if it's possible for him to fill up all of his jugs with oil or all of his jugs with wine, then it's maho ilu chachamim b'takanatam. It's a whole different kind of a question. The kind of question is, why would Chazal make a rule that's so easily circumventable? Meaning one question is, am I allowed to give this to him, tell him these containers, because is that Alif the Avia question? To that, it says, he doesn't think that Mishnah in Yerushalmi was talking about that issue at all, because they understood, like the consensus of authorities understand, going out throughout Jewish history, that we're allowed to assume the best about the situation, even if it's not the most possible way. We're allowed to assume the guy's going to keep Shemitah the right way, and he's not going to take more than he should take, in terms of lifting Eva issues, in terms of whether or not we have to feel that we are ourselves contributing to his possible violation of the Torah. The real question is, why would Chazal make a rule about how many containers I can sell a guy if he can so easily get around it? I mean, they said, don't sell him more than 5 containers of oil and 15 containers of wine, because that's the amount you're allowed to buy, you're allowed to take from Hefker in a Shemitah year. Okay, but if I sell him that many containers, he can fill them all with oil, fill them all with wine. Again, I don't have to assume that he will in terms of lifting Iver issues, but this is what they're saying. The question of the Gemara was, but why would Chazal make a rule that's so easily circumventable? That's called Maho Ilu Chachamim B'Takanatam. What are Chazal doing for us? They make a rule, and I can get around it so easily. What are they helping us? Now, the answer might be, well, but you make the rule to help people understand what the right amounts are, and that's why they make the rule. But in any case, that's the way Cesar understands that, so yeah. His other answer is that this may be an exceptional case, that since it's so easily circumventable, so easily gotten around, it'll cause perhaps zilzul, which means zilzul means not only will people violate it, but they'll violate it and like pretend like it's not a rule at all, and they won't care about it, and you don't want to foster that. So again, it wouldn't be a technical lifting iver question, am I not fostering lack of observance? It would be a sort of second level lifting iver question. It's am I not fostering mistreatment of halach? Am I not fostering the people treat halach as if it's silly, as if they can just treat it with the back of their hands and stuff like that? And that's why, that was what the question was. And then he said, I saw a Sefer Shavat Aris, which I think is Rav Kook's Sefer. He said, I saw another answer to this question, which would be that if these kinds of containers aren't so different from each other, so then maybe you have to worry, in this case, more than usual, because the common practice of people is that if they have a bunch of containers and they're roughly the same, they'll use them for roughly the same purpose. So if I'm going to sell a guy 20 containers, which look basically the same, even though it's true that 5 of them were meant for oil and 15 of them were meant for wine, don't I have to particularly worry there that they're going to use them all for the same purpose? That would be a lifting iver question. Am I not fostering his lack of observance of Shemitah? But it's not because the principle that we can assume the best isn't a principle. It's because in that situation, the question is whether there is such an assumption, because isn't it a greater assumption, a much greater assumption, that when people have containers that look roughly the same, that all these are the same? So that's a piece of a responsum that Tzeliezer wrote in 1950 on Zot Chanukah, on the second day of Tevet, to this Rav Aaron Zatzlansky about lifting iver issues. And that's, I think, and I hope, interesting issues that were raised. But I was struck by the name Rav Aaron Zatzlansky. I'd never heard of him. I tried to look him up on the internet. I don't think I found so much about him. And then I looked him up in my Bar Ilan, and he pops up all over the place. I just want to review in the time that we have left, and again, I won't do all of these tshuvot, I'll raise some of the issues that he dealt with in his correspondence with more than one of the great rabbis of the time. And I found it interesting to watch his career in correspondence, as it were. I don't know of any svarim that he wrote, but he has an active career as a Talmud Chacham in correspondence. So that goes back to the earliest one that I found was, there's a response in Da'at Kohen, which is Rav Kook's response on Yoni Yoredeya, on Yoredeya issues, Simon Kuf Pei Zayin, 187. This is from the 14th of Shvat of Tafresh Pei Zayin of 1927, to Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky, who had written a whole letter, a Kuntres, which is like an essay, a monograph, to Rav Kook about his Igros. Apparently, by 1927, a volume of Rav Kook's letters had been published. And this, Rav Aaron Zaslansky had written him detailed responses to it. Again, I'm not going to get into all those responses because it would take us way too far afield, and my goal is to show us more something about this Rav Aaron Zaslansky. So he thanks him, and he says he hopes, Rav Kook says, he hopes that even that more Torah scholars will also pay attention to the letters, and that'll be some kind of a productive thing. That's Dot Cohen. In Shir Mishpatei Uziel, in the third volume, the Orach Chaim section, Simon Lamed Aleph, response number 31, which I think I covered on the 27th of Tammuz. So I think if you hear a list of the tape of that, I think this is the tshuva that was 27th of Tammuz, because it's dated the 27th of Tammuz of Tuf Reish Tzadi Chet of 1938. And it's about the issue of non-Jews doing malach on Shabbat, doing work, doing creative labor for a Jew on Shabbat, but they do it al dat atzmo. So we spoke about this many times, and I think I did it in that Jew for 27th of Tevet, the question of, what if I have, for example, a business, and the non-Jew does work, and I own the business, he does work at the business, but he really does it, because he wants to do it then, so I have to worry about that. Or in my house, a non-Jew walks in and assumes I need X or Y or Z and does it, what are its halachic ramifications? So that was the topic. And he writes it to Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky, and this time he says, he's writing a letter to the editors of a Torah journal called Shari Tzion. One of them was Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky. And Rav Yosef Shaul El Yashar, I think, or Yitzchak Shaul El Yashar, had written a letter and an article, and he was responding to it. And we're not going to get into that now. That's another case. A little more substantive for our purposes. Another Shut Mishpatei Uziel. This one is dated Ben Kesel Le'Asor of Tuf Reish Nun Nun, between Rosh Hashanah Kippur of Tuf Reish Nun Nun, which is really Tuf Shin, but I think he didn't like the idea of two letters. So Tuf Shin is 1939, right? It's the Yom Nerayim of 1939 to Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky, the editor of this Torah journal. So he thanks him for, he apparently had, you know, welcome to Yerushalayim. This is the time when Rav Uziel apparently moved to Yerushalayim to become the chief rabbi of the Sardi chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. So he thanks him for the welcome, and he says that you also sent me some of your Chidushei Torah. So he doesn't not write Chidushei Torah, but he doesn't write any Sfarim that I know of. So he points out that this Rav Zaslansky had mentioned is a Tosefta. The Tosefta says, "Haya Holech Lafrish Truma Umasrot." If somebody was on their way to tithe their produce, he says, "Baruch Hashem Kichanu Lafrish Truma Umaser." And then the Tosafot says, "Me'ematay mivarech lehem." From when do you make a bracha on them? So the Rav Uziel says, "Dikduk lashon e'matay mivarech mishat hafrashatam." When it says "e'matay," from when, and then it says from the time when you separate them, he says, "I think that e'matay means sort of there's an extended period of time, which means that even if there's a right time, you should have done it right when you first went." But then you could do it just before you separate them out. And if you didn't do it then, you can do it later, even when you're going to give the truma to the Kohen. The Rav Uziel thinks it's all part of that time. So that's his insight to the word me'imatai. He thinks me'imatai generally means not exactly when do you do it, but what's the range of time. So within a range of time to do something, there's going to be a best time, but there's a range of time to do it. If you think about, not that he brings it up here in this tshuva that I saw, but if you think about, let's say, the first Mishnah in Berachot, me'imatai kohen kriyat shema ba'arvin, from when, it doesn't mean from when, what's the exact right time. It means what's the start point of the range of time. So that's his answer is that. So that's a responsive to so far. We've had a letter from Rav Kook in 1927, from Rav Uziel in 1938, from Rav Uziel in 1939, another one from Rav Uziel. There's going to be two more from Rav Uziel. So Rav Uziel in the second volume, we should say Uziel, Yoredeya Simon Lamed Zayin, Kibbut, on the topic of Kibbut Avla Charmoto, the level of honor. Honor isn't the right word. The level of, let's call it filial piety, of the what a child owes their parent after the parent has passed away. This is from the third day of Mar Cheshvan of Tuf Shin Chet. This is going to be 1947, the fall of 1947. He writes again to Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky, so who had apparently commented to him on what he had said. He had said that halacha psuka mechabdo bechayav mechabdo mito bemoto, that there's an obligation of kibud avaim. Let's remember that this is not in the tshuva itself. It's me talking. You can send me comments at grothst@gmail.com. But the Gemara's definition of kibud is ma'achilo mashkeu. You give the parent food and drink. You clothe the parent. You put shoes on the parent. You take them out. You bring them home. You see to their needs. So that's what we talk about honor. Things that we more talk about colloquially about honor, like treating them certain ways. That's much more in the context of the halacha in terms of yira. So, like, for example, yirat avaim, the proper offer parent, includes not contradicting them, not even saying that you know a way to support their argument, because that implies that you know enough that they need you to help them out the argument. So those are all things about yira. But kibbutz is much more about acts of filial piety, of caring for a parent. So after a parent has passed away, it's unclear what that kibbutz would have, but Rav Uziel had said, but there is an obligation of kibbutz after. So this Rav Zaslansky had said to him that he thought there were poskim who held that that was only the Rabbanan, that after a parent passed away, any honor or filial piety for the parent is really a matter of derabbanan, of a rabbinic rule, rather than part of the original halacha d'oraita. So Rav Uziel says, look in this sefer, and look in Da'at Kohen by Rav Kook, and he said, Limaran Harav. So he's already calling him Maran Harav. This is after Rav Kook has passed away, Rav Zaslansky had written Maran Harav. And so Rav Uziel says that his answer is that he didn't read my letter so carefully, my psak so carefully, because I was writing it according to Rashi. And we have a Rashi in front of us, which talks about Kfod Avian and this, and then he goes on to that. But again, my point isn't so much to tell us all these halakhic issues, but that's a halakhic question that came up for Rav Zaslansky. And then later in Shulim Shpitei Uziel Bet, Yoredei Alamin Chet, and this is the date of the 27th of Tevet of Tav Shin Vav Bet, of Shnat Tashuv, which is interesting because the earlier tshuva was dated Tav Shin Chet. Tav Shin Vav Bet is the exact same year. I think that in between, this is the 27th of Tevet, which was already probably early 1948. I always never forget when the years change. Yeah, it's the 9th of January of 1948. Tevet is the month in which it always shifts, and since the Jewish calendar compared to the non-Jewish calendar shifts around a lot, it's always not always clear. But my Bar Ilan has a calendar and it goes back into the 1500s, so I can always look it up. Anyway, my other point was that he calls it Shnat Tashuv, which is a nice year, a nice way of saying Tav Shin Chet, but apparently he had thought of it later on because he writes it now. He's writing to this Rav Aaron Zaslansky. He says, I appreciate your letter from the 15th of Cheshvan, which is a while back. It's taken a while to get back to him, with a lot of Kiddushei Torah. And on this one, the topic that he took up here that I wanted to briefly mention was the question of whether or not a Torah scholar is required to forego his honor. Halakhically, there are all sorts of honors, all sorts of forms of honor that belong to Torah scholars. That when you meet a Torah scholar, when you deal with a Torah scholar, you have to treat them certain ways. Now, it is true that Torah scholar is allowed to be mocha, is allowed to forego that honor. So this was Zaslansky thought, not only that you're allowed to forego the honor, he thought really it's better if a Torah scholar does forego the honor, and I think many people today would say that as well. And the reason why I think people would say that is because they would say to themselves, well, if a Torah scholar is busily insisting on his honor, there's something unseemly about that, right? It's like they're thinking too much of themselves. So Uziel says he doesn't think it's true. He says, afilu mimidav chasidut v'anava. There's no reason why you have to. There's no chiyuv badavar. And it's not even a question of supererogatory, right? Above and beyond the call of duty. It's not a matter of anava, of humility, of shiflut ruach, right? Of being exceedingly modest. The ein zeh begeder nenebe chavodat Torah. And he said, I don't think it's a matter of enjoying or benefiting from the honor that's owed to Torah. Uziel says it's mitzvah lito, it's an obligation to insist on people treating you a certain way because you're a Torah scholar. And I think that's a very complicated question, which is why I thought it was so interesting. I'm not getting into it here because, again, first of all, it's not a responsum for our day, which is the second day of Tevet, which is Zot Chanukah. It's part of the correspondence with Zaslansky, but it's an issue that comes up within that correspondence that I thought was interesting. Zaslansky sort of saying Torah scholars shouldn't insist on these things, and Uziel saying, I don't know. I think it's allowed to not insist on these things. That's clearly in the sources, but he thinks there's a value in insisting on it. I think there is, I think there is also a value in insisting on it because if Torah scholars tend to be mochil on their kavod, then others get used to treating Torah scholars like they're regular people, and they forget the idea of kavod Torah that they owe. That's an interesting question. Now, on the other hand, you can have people who aren't really Torah scholars who try to get treated like Torah scholars or insist on being treated like Torah scholars, and then it becomes unseemly, and then that's even worse, right? If, let's imagine all the real Torah scholars, whatever that means, all the real Torah scholars decide to be mochil on their kavod, they decide to forego their honor, and all the not-so-real Torah scholars, but somewhat Torah scholars, decide to insist on their honor, then you get used to the idea that people who insist on their honor are the people who really don't really deserve it. So Rav Uziel points out a Gemara in the Nedarim Samach Bet Amud Aleph, which says, Shari le tzurbe merabanan, lomar tzurbe merabanan ana, one of a Torah scholar. Tzurbe merabanan is like one of the pack of students of Chazal, one of the pack of yeshiva guys. So it's not like an outstanding Torah scholar. It's a tzurbe merabanan. It's a Torah scholar. It's somebody who's learned Torah, who cares about Torah and all that. They come to a court, and there's a long line in court. We actually saw Tshuva the Ezra about Torah scholars standing in line or not standing in line, how you can or cannot let them go around the line. So you have a Torah scholar, he's allowed to say, take my court case first because I'm a Torah scholar. Because it's Korah Torah. And Rav Uziel says, and there's no Yuhara there. We often worry about the fact that people arrogate to themselves honors that don't belong to them. That's called Yuhara. If you treat yourself in a way that's beyond your station, there's an arrogance there. There's a conceitedness there. And we try to avoid, very hard to avoid that. But this is somebody's actually Torah Meir Rabbanon. The Gemara means they're allowed to do this, and there's no Yuhara there. Because the Torah says you have to treat a Torah scholar that way. Then, this is Rav Uziel's position. He, and I think it's a continuum, and I think you can be on one end of the continuum be inappropriate, have an appropriate view, and another end of the continuum have an appropriate view, but it reminds us of the continuum of, if there are Torah scholars out there, to what extent is it a proper or appropriate or good that they either insist on their honor or the other extreme that they forego their honor or somewhere in between? Interesting question. Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think here's an example that comes up that I can imagine. Let's suppose you have a rabbi in a community. So in our communities today, rabbis want to be friendly with people, and there's a good value to that. So what did that do in terms of people calling them by their first name? It's an issue that I used to face when I was a rabbi in a community that I've seen other rabbis in the community face. I know a rabbi once said to me that the people who call him by his first name are the ones that shouldn't, and the people that would plausibly be have the right to call him by his first name because they're just good friends also are the ones who are very careful to always call him rabbi. So I think it's an interesting question, it's an issue that comes up in this correspondence with Rav Zaslansky. So far we've had the Tzitzit Eliezer, we've had who did it in 1951, 52. We had Rav Cook from 1927. We had now two of Rav Uziel's ending in 1948. Now you have a Shut Yabia Omer Chelik Aleph Or Chaim Simon Chavchet. This was 1950. Sorry, it was Chanukah of 1950. Now I have Yabia Omer. You have Rav Yosef getting to the act. He also has an interaction. This is ER of Tavshin Yud Bet. Remember that Rav Yosef doesn't always date his Shuvot at all. So from ER of 1952, which is after the Tzitzit letter, to Rav Yitzchak Zaslansky. Now already he is the Yoshev Rosh HaMoetzah Datit Yerushalayim. He's the chairman of the religious council of the city of Jerusalem. And this is from Yabia Omer Chelik Aleph Or Chaim Simon Chavchet. He says, I got your letter. And included in the letter, you had written to me about the fact that I, Rav Yosef, Paskin in Sefer Chazon Ovadia, which is a book of Tshuvot of his, I think about the Siddur issues in particular. So Rav Yosef had written that women can have a Seder on their own. If they don't have a husband, if they don't have men around, that's fine, halachically. There's no issue with that. You have a single woman, you have a group of women who aren't with families for whatever reason. He says, I think they can have a Seder. And he said, they can make a bracha. They can make the bracha of Asher Gealano. Asher Gealano is the bracha we make at the end of reciting the Seder story, just before we drink the second cup of wine and then move on to the mitzvot of matzah and of eating the meal and things like that. And maror, eating the meal. He had said they can make that bracha even if there are no men around. Now remember, and it's in the next tshuva that we'll get to as well, the next tshuva we're going to get to is from Shvat of Tavshin Tet Zion of 1957. So it's again to Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zaslansky. So he's going to talk about the issue of that Rav Yosef's position was that women, based on Sephardic Psak, it's not his revolutionary position, the position was that women don't make bracha in general on Mitzvot Haseh Shazman Grama. So here they can make a bracha, Sheh Galanu. This was Zaslansky was unclear as to why Rav Yosef thought that they can make that bracha. Where's their obligation in that bracha? So Rav Yosef says, because women are obligated, just like men are obligated, in the mitzvah Sipur Yetziyah Mitzrayim, the telling of the Egypt story, they're obligated in doing that. They're obligated in the Haggadah, and possibly also they're obligated in the four kosot. And the second kos immediately follows this bracha, and that's part of the obligation, and therefore he thinks they're clearly included in that as well. The next shiva is from the third volume of Yabia Omer, Or Chaim Simon Vav, from Shvat Tavshin Tet Zayin, as I said. And he says, I wrote in Yabia Omer about the Mogen Avraham says that women don't have to make a Birchas Kriyat Shema. So the Mogen Avraham had said that they don't have to make Birchas Kriyat Shema because that's connected to Shema itself. It's connected to Shema itself because he sees, the Mogen Avraham sees it, other people disagree. I think the Mogen Avraham sees it as sort of a bracha attached to the obligation of Shema. If that's true, Right? And Shema has specific times. If that's true, Rav Ozad Yosef wrote, that he thinks it means that women can't make the bracha because the Sephardic psak is, his Sephardic psak is, women don't make bracha on mitzvah Shema and grama, and that should apply to Birchos Kriyat Shema as well. So Sephardi women, Rav Yosef seems to hold, should not say Birchos Kriyat Shema. They say Shema if they want to, because women are allowed to fulfill, clearly are allowed to fulfill mitzvah Shema and grama, but they can make the brachos on them, and this would count as a bracha on them. And this, Rav Zlotsky strongly disagreed. He thought that it's not true that it's a birchos a mitzvah. It's not a bracha on the mitzvah. And he quoted a gra, and the gra had pointed out that if you make say shema after a certain amount of time of the day, you didn't lose the brachos. So Rav Yosef is going to disagree with him, and he goes on and have that discussion. And we're running out of time, so the coup de grace from my perspective, or the last really interesting one was Shut Sri Deish. The Sri Deish is Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who lived most of his life in after the war. He lived his life after the war, not most of his life at all, but his life after World War II, after the Holocaust, he lived in Switzerland. So in Sri Deish, Chelek Aleph, Simon Hay, this is dated to the Wednesday of Parshat Shmot of Tufshin Yutet. I looked it up. It's December 31st, 1958, the 20th of Tevet. And this is the last one that I have to Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zeslansky. And this is a tshuva about, it's about issues of when you do or don't pay attention to your tefillin, how you, what the status of somebody falls asleep in the tefillin is, making brachos on it. We don't have time to get into it at all. I will only point out that the end of the tshuva, we're talking about a certain sefer, and then Yaakov Weinberg says, I don't have the sefer. If you could get it from me or borrow it from me, I would greatly, greatly appreciate it, because it's sort of like he's living there in Montreal, a little bit isolated. He's a great Torah scholar, but he recognized the lacks in his library, and he very much liked them to be filled in. But to me, starting with a Tzitzit Eliezer for the second of Tevet, and you may remember this is the responsible day for the second of Tevet, and if I forgot to, I want to certainly thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hochhauser, and the OU for helping us put these shiurim online. From the second, we started the second of Tevet of 19, of Tufshin Yud Aleph, of Chanukah, the last day of Chanukah of 1950, with the Tzitzit Eliezer, Chelek Dalid, Simon Hay, Perek Dalid, where he spoke about Lifnei Iver issues, and that led me to notice that this man, Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zeslansky, who was in active correspondence with many of the great rabbis of his time, starting all the way back with Cook in 1927, going as far as just what I have in my Bar Ilan, going as far as the Sri Deish in 1958, over the course of 30 years, letting us get a little bit of a taste of this man's life, Rav Aaron Yitzchak Zeslansky, and his relationship with Rav Cook, with Rav Uziel, with Rav Yosef, with Tzitzit Eliezer, and with the Sri Deish. This is Gideon Rothstein, responsibility for the second of Tevet. Have a great day.